Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
It's a date every American learns, the attack on Pearl Harbor. 2 months later, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which authorized the relocation of Japanese and Japanese Americans in the United States.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our West Coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move.
The War Relocation Authority, a federal agency, produced films to defend the new policy of internment.
Neither the Army nor the War Relocation Authority relished the idea of taking men, women, and children from their homes, their shops, and their farms. So the military and civilian agencies alike determined to do the job as a democracy should, with real consideration for the people involved.
But many Japanese Americans refused to leave, risking arrest. Fred Korematsu, a resident of Oakland, California, was one of them. Fred passed away in 2005, but in a series of interviews before his death, he explained why he chose to defy the order.
I felt that it was wrong because to be pushed into this evacuation and also threatened with punishment because you look like the enemy. They don't say you're an American citizen because they've taken the American citizen away from you, which is wrong.
Korematsu was eventually picked up by the police in San Francisco and charged with violating the president's executive order. His family was moved to the Central Utah War Relocation Center in Topaz, Utah. But with the help of the ACLU, Korematsu sued the government, taking his case all the way to the Supreme Court.
I felt that I was an American citizen, and I had just as much right as anyone else. And being accused as the enemy, which I have no part of it, I don't even have any ties with Japan, nor have I ever been there. And to be accused like this, well, I just thought it wasn't fair. It was wrong.
In 1944, the court reached the 6-3 decision against Korematsu, finding that Executive Order 9066 was constitutional in the name of national security. And it's that case, Korematsu versus the United States, that Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor cited in her dissent on Tuesday in Trump versus Hawaii, the 5-4 decision that upheld the president's ban on travel mostly from Muslim nations. Chief Justice John Roberts argued that Korematsu had, quote, nothing to do with this case, but took the step to announce that the Supreme Court was overruling the 1944 decision. So where does that leave the nation on the question of discrimination and national security? This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And today we're looking back at Korematsu versus United States to better understand the court's decision to uphold a president's travel ban this week. Noah Feldman is a professor of law at Harvard University, and he's a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion.
It's generally considered one of the worst Supreme Court opinions in the modern history of the court, because essentially in that case, the court deferred to the president's national security justification for interning Japanese Americans, when in reality, there was really no need to do so. And so the result is that the modern court generally only mentions Korematsu as an example of what not to do. It's a sort of model of bad Supreme Court decision making.
So when we look at yesterday's ruling, I think what stood out to us, and I think to a lot of folks, was how Justice Sonia Sotomayor did invoke the Korematsu case. Tell us a little bit about her strategy in doing that.
Well, Justice Sotomayor was trying to make the point that this is not just your ordinary bad decision by the conservative majority of the court. Rather, this is the kind of bad decision that will rank with some of the worst decisions ever made by the court. And in particular, what she said was that in the Korematsu case, the Supreme Court listened to President Roosevelt's fake national security justification. And here she said a reasonable observer would take one look at the so-called Muslim travel ban and say, look, this is based on animus. This is based on bias and discrimination. So that is the message that she was trying to send to the majority, and the majority was listening. That's very clear from Chief Justice John Roberts' response.
And tell us a little about Chief Justice Roberts' response to this specific raising of Korematsu.
Well, being accused of authoring an opinion that's on the same standard of badness as Korematsu is serious business. And so Chief Justice Roberts first denied that his decision was anything like Korematsu. And then he said that for good measure, he was going to take the opportunity to say something the court had never explicitly said before, namely that Korematsu was a bad decision, that it was wrong the day it was decided, and that it had been, he said, quote, overruled by the court of history, close quote. So he was really essentially trying to change the subject by saying, let's tell the world that we've actually said that Korematsu is wrong, in the hopes of deflecting attention from the fact that Justice Sotomayor was comparing his decision itself to Korematsu.
But saying that the court of history overruled it is one thing, but actually overruling a decision, is that even possible?
Well, it is in theory possible to overrule a decision, but only if the same issues come before the court again. So what the Chief Justice could do is sort of make a declaration, what lawyers call dicta, words that say, we don't like this, we won't follow it, but they don't actually obligate the court not to follow it in the future. So this is a symbolic statement, and it's a statement that future litigants would be unwise if they were to quote Korematsu. But it can't literally be an overruling because the issues in this case were different from the issues in the Korematsu case.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because the role of quote-unquote national security is something that's playing both in this decision and in Korematsu. Can you give us the distinction between how it's played out in both of these decisions?
Sure. I think from an ordinary viewer's perspective, it's actually really similar in that in both instances, the government did something, the executive branch, in fact, and said, we have a national security reason for doing this, and the court let them get away with it. So in that sense, they're similar, and that's what Justice Sotomayor was saying. The technical difference between the two circumstances is that in the Korematsu case, the government said that it was detaining people based on the threat to national security, not based on their race, and the court accepted that and said, yes, that's true, and therefore there was no violation of the equal protection of the Constitution. What was at issue here was the subtly different question of whether the court should even consider the argument that President Trump's ban was based on religious animus. And what the court said is that in a circumstance where the president is acting within his core national security power, as long as the rule is on its face, not based on discrimination, it won't look to the possibility of discrimination. So that's very subtly technically different from the Korematsu situation.
Subtly, but it's obviously, it's had a huge impact, or it will have a huge impact. What is the sort of bar for determining religious animus on its face versus real religious animus? I feel like often in legal circles, it's hard to prove intent. Is that what we're talking about here? The intent of the president versus what is actually being debated?
Well, that is a big part of it. The question is, what will you look at to prove intent? And what I believe and what Justice Sotomayor was saying is that you should look at all of the circumstances, including how plausible is the president's justification and who does the order apply to. What the court said, though, was that it would not look to those circumstances as long as written, there was no explicit form of discrimination. In Korematsu, if you ask Chief Justice Roberts, he would say, well, the law mentioned Japanese Americans. Whereas here, the law doesn't say Muslims. It just lists people from seven countries, five of whom the ones that are mainly directed at are Muslim countries.
Does Justice Sotomayor's dissent pave the way for this case to be disregarded by future courts?
Justice Sotomayor is sending a message to future courts through the pages of the Supreme Court report saying, this is a bad one, and someday the court should repudiate this judgment the same way that the court is now repudiating Korematsu, a decision from several generations ago. So that's what her dissent is intended to do. It's intended to say, we were here, we know this was about bias, and history, don't pretend that we didn't know. And in fact, someone played a very similar role in the Korematsu decision. That was Justice Frank Murphy. Similarly said, this is about discrimination on the basis of race against Japanese Americans, and we should not forget that. And today, his dissent is remembered long after the majority opinions are treated as wrong.
And so is there any possibility of having this relitigated? Where does it go from here?
Well, there's a tiny, tiny sliver of a possibility. Justice Kennedy wrote a separate concurrence in which, in very contorted language, he said that it would be up to the lower court to figure out if, even with all of the deference to the executive that the Supreme Court has called for, there was still enough evidence of anti-religious bias to justify going forward. So in theory, if there were lots of new evidence that could be introduced at trial of bias on the part of the president, that could potentially be used to bring the case back up through the courts. The problem is that we already know, and it's already public, what the president's motivations were here because he said them. And
well, that's what I was going to ask you. Are tweets admissible?
Yes, in principle, tweets are admissible, but here they've already been, as it were, disclosed to the court, and the Supreme Court said that those were not enough in light of the fact that the government had also offered a what they called a plausible justification separate from the possibility of bias. So essentially the court said, well, maybe there's bias here, but we're not going to even look at that question in a serious way because there's another possible non-biased reason that has been offered. I think a crucial thing to keep in mind about this opinion is not to allow the formalism of the court's writing and its insistence that, well, we have a rule of law here that suggests that we don't have to listen to obscure the reality, which is that everybody, including all of the justices of the Supreme Court, knows that this travel ban grew out of the first two rounds of travel bans, which were themselves explicitly justified by the president's claim on the campaign trail that he was going to keep Muslims out of the country. We all know this, and the part of you that is saying this can't be right is correct.
And I'm wondering what this tells us, if you could give us a sense of what does this tell us about the court overall under the Trump administration? Are we going to expect many more decisions like this, which are clearly divided on political and partisan lines?
The answer is yes. This has been one of the more expressly partisan with conservative outcomes terms of the court in recent memory. Often, Justice Anthony Kennedy has been a swing voter in the past. This year, not so much. This year, he's overwhelmingly, almost without exception, joined the conservatives. Now, if Justice Kennedy resigns after this term, as some have speculated that he will, then the big question is whether President Trump will be able to nominate and confirm a successor before the midterm elections. If he is, we will have a firmly conservative Supreme Court for at least another generation.
Noah Feldman is a professor of law at Harvard University and a columnist at Bloomberg. Professor Feldman, thanks for joining us.
It was my great pleasure.
And thanks to Densho Archive for providing us with access to the audio of Fred Korematsu. That interview was from 1983.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.